Hey everybody, you're listening to Swift News. This is the weekly news show all about iOS development where I take everything I found on Twitter, newsletters, Slack channels, YouTube, you name it, I curate all that information into a weekly show for you to make sure you stay up to date. Now this is the audio version of the show that I usually do on my YouTube channel, youtube.com/SeanAllen, all about iOS development. And on that show, I'll usually have the blog post up and I'll be highlighting the text that I'm talking about. When I show videos of the AR kit examples, you can actually see them. So this podcast is for people that are on the go and can't sit in front of the computer but still want the news. However, if you do want to see all those visuals that I talk about, be sure to check out the YouTube video. All right, with that out of the way, on to Swift News. What's going on, everybody? It's Monday. Time for that Swift news. Apologies for this being a little late this morning. I feel very, very sick, but the show must go on. And before we dive into the news, I want to make a quick announcement. I'm super pumped to announce that I'm speaking for the first time in March of this upcoming year in London at iOSCon 2019. As you can see here, I'm on day one, kind of kicking off the show right behind John Sindel's keynote. You see my talk here, 30 Xcode tips in 45 minutes. So if you are in the London area or just the UK in general, I'll be in the neighborhood in March thinking about doing a meetup or something. More details to follow. Stay tuned. And with that out of the way, let's just jump into the news. Kicking things off, I want to talk about a breaking change coming in Swift 5. Paul Hudson has a great article describing that. And that is it's changing the way try handles optionals. And the reason I wanted to bring this up is because, you know, as he says here in the very opening line, is the Swift team has worked hard to maintain source compatibility since Swift 3.0. So basically, if you've been around since Swift 3, you remember that was breaking changes everywhere. That was a brutal transition. But since then, you know, the Swift team has tried to minimize any breaking changes. So when they do introduce a breaking change, it's kind of a big deal. And this is one of them coming in Swift 5. So I wanted to let everybody know that this is coming. And essentially what happens is try makes it very easy to introduce like a nested optional. And Paul gives a good example here in the code. You know, to sum this up, basically has a failable initializer up here. And he just does that so the user can return an optional. Now there's many, many reasons your object can be optional. So, but anyway, so when you put try in front of that, now, as he says right here, in Swift 4.2 and earlier, this would make the messages a string ?? So that is an optional string. But with Swift 5.0 and later, basically try won't wrap the values in an optional if they're already an optional. So messages will just be string, you know, one optional. So it basically flattens that out. And this is a great change because, you know, as Paul points out here, most people are already flattening it, you know, themselves by hand. So this takes care of that. And then this also brings try in line with as, you know, an optional chaining just makes the language more consistent, like he says. So again, breaking change coming in Swift 5 with how try handles optionals. So be on the lookout for that. Next up, let's talk about accessibility, or A11Y as the kids call it. But there's a great article from, we'll just say Nick. Is your app accessible? Probably not, but here's how to find out. So this isn't necessarily a tutorial on how to make your app accessible, but I liked it because it really shows you how to find out if your app is accessible or not by using VoiceOver. It shows you how to turn VoiceOver on and go through your app. And the reason I think this is important is because, yes, if you are visually impaired or need this feature, you're probably already familiar with this. However, a lot of developers, you know, may not be familiar with this, and myself included. I'm just as guilty as kind of neglecting accessibility. And sadly, that happens a lot, which is why I want to share this article. So hopefully many of you will go out there and test your apps using VoiceOver. And this article basically shows you how to do that. So real quick, I'll give a rundown of VoiceOver if you're not familiar with it. You can turn it on. He shows you how to turn it on. You just go to Settings, General, Accessibility, turn on VoiceOver, and then he has this absurdly large screenshot here. But basically, the way VoiceOver works, and it says it in the screenshot, but I'll go down to the words here, is by tapping once anywhere on the screen, you essentially cycle through the tappable elements. And then as you're cycling through, when you get to the element you want, you would double tap on it to actually interact with that element. And that's how VoiceOver works in a nutshell. But you can also, instead of tapping to get to new things, you can swipe to just, you know, cycle through. But definitely turn this on your phone and play around with the app you're creating or other apps just to try it out, just to make sure your app, you know, is accessible. And this is, there's a benefit to using like Apple's out of the box stuff, like their segmented controls or their buttons, because they do accessibility pretty well out of the box by default. If you're creating all kinds of custom UI elements that you built yourself, you're that's fine, but you're just not going to get all this built-in accessibility, and you have to go and do it yourself. And then real quick, if we switch to Xcode here, I just have my simple user defaults project that I did, but I'll show you how to use it here. So as you can see these elements, I'm clicking on the UI image view. Over on the right in the identity inspector, you can see down here towards the bottom, you see accessibility. See my image view by default, and I haven't changed any of these settings yet, wasn't enabled. Maybe you want it, maybe you don't want that, but you would just turn that on. You can give it a label, a hint, an identifier, and this is what the voiceover will read. So you want this to be descriptive for somebody, who's visually impaired. And then as you can see, if I click on my button here, the save button, you see it's already enabled by default because this is UIKit's, default stuff. The trait is a button and it is user interaction enabled. So obviously this isn't meant to be an accessibility tutorial, but I wanted to point out where it is real quick so you can run through your app and check to make sure anything that you want to be interactive with voiceover and accessibility is ready to go. So definitely check that out. Moving on, we have a really interesting read about the analysis of the Nest app for iOS. Now, we've all been seeing this lately, how iOS app like Facebook is kind of infamous for it. Just their app is huge. And everybody wonders, like, why is this app so big? And John Gruber pointed this out about the Nest app, how it's 241 megabytes. He says, somehow I'm thinking maybe the Nest app is a little bloated. So what this article does is it just does a breakdown of what is actually in the app. And it was very, very interesting. I thought I've never seen a breakdown like this before. So basically what he says, they downloaded this on an iPad Air 2 where it says 206 megabytes, was the size. But basically it goes through, here's the breakdown. This doesn't make sense yet, but we'll dive deeper. And this is the image that I think is really, really telling here, how the color codes the sections of the app. You see, Frameworks makes up 55 gig. Jasper, which is the code name for the app, is actually 22 megabytes. Localizations is 33 megabytes, so that's quite big. And just extra assets, 31 megabytes. The Watch app, 23. So all this stuff comes together to get you to that file size. And then there's further dissection of each of these. And a couple interesting things, this app has a lot of extra assets, like, movies, onboarding stuff to help people set up their device. So that's kind of understandable that the assets would be quite large. However, maybe they could have optimized the images some more. He has a list of images here. You can see the sizes. Like there's a lot of 600 and 500 kilobyte images, a whole bunch of them that are quite big. And he'd show some screenshots. Localizations was 33 megabytes because it's not just the strings, because I think the strings for each language total like 1 megabyte. So that wasn't it. But all their images and assets are also localized. For example, using Fahrenheit versus Celsius in the images, that kind of stuff. So that's what causes the localization to be, here's the example of that. And one interesting thing they found is this wasn't in the asset catalog. So here you see, as an attentive reader might have spotted, a second optimization, since the images are not stored in the asset catalog, app slicing does not take effect. You'll note that the images are available in the 1x, 2x, and 3x resolutions, although my device will only load the 2x resolution. So if you're not familiar with app slicing, that's basically what it does. Yes, you upload the 1x, 2x, and 3x, but for example, if your phone can't handle the 3x, the App Store is not going to download the 3x assets for you. So Apple takes care of that. But your assets have to be in the asset catalog in Xcode for that to happen. So if that's not the case, you're downloading all those assets, even though you're not going to use them. So anyway, frameworks take up a huge amount. They dissect the frameworks. I recommend checking out this article. Like I said, it was pretty enlightening to see, all the stuff that made up what makes the app so big. And, maybe when you're doing your app, you can kind of use some of these optimizations to, not make your app so big. Up next, we have a very enlightening article from Jordan Morgan all about optimizing images. I actually learned a lot in this, and this is a long technical article, so I'm really going to kind of keep it surface level and give you the TLDR versions, which he does as well at the bottom. But basically we'll just start off. It says, in theory, pop quiz. How much memory does this 266 kilobyte, and quite dashing, photo of my beautiful daughter require in an iOS app? Here's the photo in question. And it says, spoiler alert, it's not 266 kilobytes. It's not 2.66 megabytes, it's 14 megabytes. So, and we go into why. That's the key here. It's like, you think 266 kilobyte pictures, not that big. But in memory, for this particular picture, it is. So, here's the big question. Why? Basically, iOS essentially derives its memory hit from the image's dimensions, not necessarily the file size, like how big it is. And he says the dimensions of this photo are at, 1718 by, 2018. So it's a big picture dimension-wise. And then we go into why that is in this rendering pipeline. And again, I learned a lot in this article. And if your app deals with images a lot, highly, highly recommend reading this. Almost a must-read. So the rendering pipeline. So it loads. iOS takes the compressed image and loads it, 266 bytes into memories. No big deal. The decoding is where, you know, the bad stuff happens. I don't know if I can call it bad, but basically now iOS takes the images and converts that into a way a GPU can read and understand it. So now it's uncompressed. And that's where that 14 megabyte size comes in because of the dimensions. It was so big. And then once you render, just like it sounds, that image data is rendered into however you want to put it, even if it's only, you know, 60 by 60, like he says. But that decoding is where kind of the memory hit takes place is what he says here. And like I said, in an image-heavy app, that matters, right? So you want to get that, he says, that buttery smooth 60 frames per second scrolling. Like, that's tough to do as it is. So you want to be really optimized for that. But like he mentions in this little thing, like, ProMotion devices are basically going to be the norm here, I'm assuming. That's an assumption. But I imagine ProMotion devices will be the standard here in a little bit. And that is 1/120th of a second. So double the speed of that 60 frames per second, you know, buttery smoothness. So basically, like he says, the ante is about to be upped in performance. So you need to keep this in mind. And then he goes through like the technical aspects of it. Again, this is a very long, detailed article. I'm trying to keep it high level here. But basically, downscaling versus downsampling. And Jordan says, you know, it stands to reason that some engineers might assume, you know, logically so, that simply downscaling them via UI image will suffice, but it typically won't due to the reasons above, and that is because it decompresses the original image. And again, if that original image is a huge dimensions, we get back into that render pipeline that we talked about, and, you know, the same problems happen. So basically, back down to the TLDR version here is, on a TLDR entire article, look for opportunities to downsample images instead of using UI image to downscale them. I'd really like the way he wrapped up this article, just because it really kind of sums up development. So I'm just going to go ahead and read that. He says, "You don't know what you don't know." And this is the great line. And in programming, you're basically signing up for an entire career of always running 10,000 miles an hour just to keep pace with the innovations and change, which means there's going to be a mountain of APIs, frameworks, patterns, optimizations you simply, you know, weren't aware of. And that really hits close to home with me, because as a content, you know, creator, I get asked to make videos about certain topics, or I get asked questions on certain topics. And as you can imagine, they range the whole gamut. And I'm just like, I don't know everything, you know, it's like, I think I'm a pretty, you know, okay developer, but man, I get questions. And I think people just assume that I just know all this stuff. And Jordan just hits the nail on the head. It's just, it's impossible to know everything. You know, you're gonna have APIs you didn't even know existed, let alone know them enough to do a video on them or a blog post. So yeah, and then he goes on to say, and that can certainly be true with images. Most of the time you initialize the UI image view with some beautiful pixels and move on, you know, Moore's law, whatever. You know, these phones are powerful, they can handle it, but the good point here that I want to really emphasize here is, but dance with the devil long enough and he's bound to rear his horns. So basically it's like, don't get in the habit of just assuming everything's going to be okay, again, especially if your app is very image heavy. So like I said, if your app is image heavy, must read article. Next up, I want to share a very interesting UI interaction that the Soar app is doing, and it's pull to reach. I don't know if that's the official name, but basically, as you can see in this image, as you're pulling it down, the farther you pull, you can look at the navigation kind of at the top, and it is cycling through the navigation elements based on how far you pull. And I think this is interesting just because of how tall these phones are getting, and if the navigation elements are at the top, you gotta like use its separate hand, it's like a pain. So this is more one-handed use of the phone, but just really, really interesting. I don't know if this will take off yet or how sensitive that would be. Like, is it more annoying than useful? I don't know, I haven't used it, but it was really, really intriguing, and I thought a really innovative way to navigate around your app just by pulling down, you know, a certain amount to navigate around. So keep an eye on this. I think this has a chance to, you know, become a thing. I don't know, it's interesting. Let me know what you think in the comments about this. And then we have a good article from Chris Yates, says, "Don't develop an app for the money." I've talked about this a lot, but I think it's good to just kind of reinforce every once in a while, every few months or so. But basically what this article is about is how, you know, back in the heyday of the App Store, 2009, the gold rush, you know, independent developers, you know, could make a fairly simple app and make good money on the App Store. But eventually there was a race to the bottom. You know, as we all know, apps all became like 99 cents or free. Now people, the expectations are set now. People don't like to pay for an app. You know, we know as developers, these apps takes us months and months to make. And then when somebody scoffs at paying 99 cents for it, you're like, what? Like, what? Are you serious? I put all this work into it. It's 99 cents. And you're saying it should be free. But that's the expectation we've set for the market. So anyway, what this article really talks about is, and it's a highlighted line, says, "So why develop an app, right?" It says, "If you intend to develop an app, do it for the love of it. Do it for your own creative mind. Do it because it's something you enjoy, but don't think you'll become rich," essentially. And I just think that's the right idea to just, you know, I know there's a lot of new developers that watch my show. So Just keep that in mind. Don't get me wrong. There's always exceptions to the rule, right? You could come up with the perfect app at the perfect time and make amazing money on the App Store. I'm not saying that can happen, but just keep in mind, you are the exception, not the rule. That just doesn't really happen all that often anymore. So keep that in mind. Do it for the love of it. Do it because maybe you're solving your own problem and hopefully somebody else will get some use out of it. But don't do it thinking you're going to get rich, just to set those expectations. And onto the design portion of the show, we have an article from Lisa from Flawless talking about just 30 beautiful examples of animations in iOS. Now, I love just going through these types of blog posts, so I wanted to share it. Some really cool animations and interactions. When I'm scrolling through these, I love this one, this transition. I think that's just an awesome transition. But anyway, as I'm scrolling through these, one, I'm getting inspiration for, you know, design, animations, how different UI people are building, different interactions. So I'm getting inspiration, but I'm also, and I think this is a good exercise, as I'm scrolling through, real quick, I don't spend a lot of time on it, but I'm always like, okay, how would I build that? Okay, that's interesting. Like looking at this one, I'm like, how would I build this washing machine animation? And the truth is, this would probably be a Lottie animation that, you know, a designer would do in After Effects. It's probably what it is. But, you know, just things like this. Okay, this is typically probably a page view controller with a, you know, animation in the middle. But I just do this little exercise, just a real quick, like 3 to 4 second thought on like how I would actually build these animations. But again, I recommend it. A lot of inspiration, maybe test yourself on how you would build some of these, good stuff. And then we have our LOLs of the week. Here you see in the comic 1969, what are you doing with that 2 kilobytes of RAM? Sending people to the moon. And then in 2018, what are you doing with that 1.5 gig of RAM? Running Slack. And my favorite part of this is this little subtle whoosh from the computer just taking off. And then this one's just self-explanatory, you know, estimating software projects. So that's going to wrap it up for this week's episode of Swift News. If you like what I'm doing here, consider subscribing. I put out Swift News every Monday and then a tutorial or two throughout the week. See you in the next one.